You can talk about musical composition, arrangement, and performance. Or you can just say Ellington. Same thing. There was not just one, but there were two iconic Ellingtons. There was the father and the son. And then there was the mistress, the music. I'm Fred Macy, and this is The Jazz Scene, dedicated to the preservation, promotion, and appreciation of jazz, America's classical music. Back in my radio days, I had the distinct pleasure of interviewing Duke Ellington's son Mercer, an accomplished musician and prolific composer in his own right. It was actually more of a visit than it was an interview. We sort of kicked back in his Park Avenue apartment in Manhattan with a huge pot of coffee and a New York-sized pile of Danish. And for 2 hours, we talked about making music, playing music, and his loving yet sometimes uneasy relationship with his dad, the Duke. This is the third and final of three extremely candid parts. A rare look at the famous father through the eyes of his son as he struggles to emerge from his father's giant shadow, while at the same time carrying on the Duke's legacy. Personal reflections by Mercer Ellington of both legendary careers.
How would Duke Ellington describe his music? How would he describe it?
He wouldn't. He hated categories. And the fact that he hated categories, he hated the word jazz. He did not want his work to be referred to as jazz because the word itself came from the brothels of New Orleans. And he didn't want his work described as such. One of his great pastimes, as was Strayhorn's, was the composition of words. The one thing that made the old man a little more concerned about the fact that rock had come into vogue was not the music itself, but the fact that it brought in a series of words that didn't require the development of the dexterity in which to write and say things. I mean, this stuff was so common, there was no real education involved in it, special condition probably, but not anything that was anywhere near the realm of heart or the great people who like Ira Gershwin and so forth. They had this tremendous command of words, which was an art in itself. And here he had done all this studying for a period of easily 10 to 20 years just to work at words. And suddenly it's as if there was no opening for him to get into.
Yeah, that's interesting.
A lot of people are aware of his work, but not aware of the fact that he was involved in the words that are in the work. For instance, A Drum is a Woman is a work that was done as a television show for U.S. Steel out. Well, the words to everything in there was written by Duke Ellington.
Yeah, I didn't realize he did lyrics.
Yeah, and like I say, he was involved in the whole end of it, doing the lyrics, singing them, and so forth.
Did he have a particular message or something that he was trying to say through his music, or did that change?
Well, it's strange that you should say that, because we're going to do a concert in October of this year, and we're calling the title of the concert is A Message from Duke, and it involves all the songs that Ellington subtly placed his philosophy in, and yes, he did have messages that he did send.
Essentially, what might some of those have been?
Well, some on the racial issue, criticism or suggestions about what they should be, and not just criticisms in every area that you can think of. He criticizes his own race for some of the things that they did. For certain situations wherein blacks, well, actually Africans, sold Africans as slaves first, and then even after they got here, Negroes or blacks or whatever you want to call them for that particular period became free and bought slaves themselves. He goes and gets involved in this, and he has statements he makes which are being said, and if you don't know what they're based on, you won't really understand why and how he got into it.
So most every song he had, would you say, did have some kind of a message? He was a musical commentator.
No, very seldom. Every so often, he would feel strongly enough about an issue where he'd do it, and sometimes he'd do it blatantly. Like one tune he has, it was called Martin Fit the Battle of Alabama. And he definitely did this as far as Martin was concerned. Martin Luther King, I think, if anyone, was Ellington's main and favorite hero. He's aware, and he had the most extravagant and complete collection of books on black history of anyone that I've ever seen or known of.
Let's get back over to Duke Ellington as a musician or as a performer. Did he prefer recording sessions, clubs? Did he like, obviously he went with the big band format most of the time. How did he feel about smaller groups?
Well, I think he felt that the combination of all of it was necessary for the freedom and the flow. You get into a place, cabaret, and the guys would be feeling loose and all that, and all of a sudden out of nowhere they would decide to develop something or make a jam it into a tune. And he would make that tune because come his, just by fooling around and certain guys doing things with it, like All of Me, Sunny Side of the Street, and lately tune like Together. He would just, they'd make that tune theirs. And he wouldn't place any great confidence in it until he had the approval of the audience. Now, it would either take a dance, a record, or cabaret before he was absolutely certain that this was had the qualification to be placed on a concert. Once in a while he'd do it without any proof at all.
Yeah.
But for the most part, he was on pretty safe ground. He knew he could get a certain reaction from his different materials before he'd place them in the place. And so therefore he needed each stage of the field to be prepared for the other. He
sort of his laboratory.
Right. And he needed a successful concert to make him aware of what was really worthwhile recording.
Is there one particular performance or one particular concert that, whatever the occasion, really sticks out in your mind for any reason?
Well, of course, it would have to be Newport, 1957, when this work, which became known as 27 Choruses, or is known properly as Diminuendo in Blue, became an absolute hit. And it was so gracious to see this because we always said Ellington was ahead of his time. And this work had been written 30 years before.
And was appropriate right then.
Right.
Any other occasions that that you feel, for whatever reason, stuck out? The greatest performance, the worst performance? Did you ever give a bad performance?
The worst performance, yeah. When I say worst performance, I'm also talking about the worst reaction from the audience. It was one in which they went to France and they played, Ray Nance played violin. And it was Ozzie Bailey sang it. And it was a French tune. And it was done purely as the French would have done it. And they booed and they threw things.
Really?
Because they came to hear Duke Ellington. They didn't come to hear French music.
That was one of those examples of right. Guys leaving their half full glasses of beer behind.
Right.
Oh, that's too bad. Well, maybe that is a funny one. I was going to say, can you tell me a funny Duke Ellington story?
Well, I guess...
was semi-tragic.
Yeah. Well, so is this for that matter. We played it some years ago, a place called Marquette, Michigan. Paul Gonzalez was feeling his oats. And he'd get out there and he'd get in the middle of... Paul could always play, you know, regardless of how plastic it might have been. But on those few cases where all of a sudden he stopped playing and fall out on the stage, it used to get Ellington somewhat miffed.
I can see where it would. Yeah.
And we could get him conscious again, he started screaming at him that he was going to ship him on a slow boat to China. So we wind up playing Taipei one day, And Paul falls out in the midst of all this majesty that was there, all the ambassadors and everyone else.
Literally fell down.
Yes, my mother would say all the counts and no counts were there. Paul falls flat on his face. And we get off the stage and he comes and he waits for Paul over here and says, I'm going to ship you on a slow boat to China. I said, Pop, you can't do that. Why can't I do it? That's because you're in China.
That's beautiful, man. That's beautiful. What about a sad Duke Ellington story?
Well, I don't know of anything. It was sad. I don't think he'd want me to relate one if I could recall it. He felt that his life was belonged to entertainment. And this was, we were in a way wandering minstrels. Our purpose was to mainly make certain that the man who came to see us, or persons, or girl, or whatever, could do so and manage to forget the cares of the day. And that our purpose was not to come and either make our life seem to be more important than anything they were doing, but in a sense to serve as a way to make their life more complete and something more worthwhile.
How about a warm or compassionate Duke Ellington story?
Well, that would be the work of the church, you know, doing the different things like he did a song called Heritage, and it's dedicated to his parents. The other things in the concert is dedicated to God. And his belief in those things, Come Sunday being a tune which is becoming quite prominent, so much so that it's not only just sung in concerts and by people in a sense of semi-classical nature, but it's accepted as a jazz work, and quite often played by our greatest jazz soloist around.
Do you have a single outstanding memory of your dad as a musician, first of all? If you had to name just one thing and say, this is the most outstanding memory I have about him, this I will carry with me forever as a musician.
It's very difficult. Pop was so prolific in the many things that he stood for and represented that you'd have trouble, and I possibly might come up with an answer if you gave me another couple of hours to formulate and think of it, but just at the, which means that basically it doesn't exist, because if it doesn't come to the surface immediately, it's not there.
What about your most outstanding memory of him as a father?
Well, as I said, things ain't what they used to be would be that, because this illustrated his ability to keep track and know exactly what you were doing at any time and all, and demonstrated his watchful eye despite the apparent lack of it.
Generally as a person?
As a person? The one thing I think about Ellington as a person is that the one thing he was not is a hypocrite. I mean, if he basically represented something, wanted to think about it, do it, the certain thing is that he would live it and try to demonstrate it in the fashion in which he was working at it.
You worked in his shadow for a lot of years and worked darn hard from what I can gather. You finally have come, obviously, to some sort of peace, come to terms with yourself on the issue of being Ellington's kid. At what point did you really come to terms with that? Have you, in fact, come to terms with that? I'm impressed that you probably came to terms with it. How did you work that through? That's got to be a tough one.
I don't know. When Pop was alive, one thing I had big arguments with, as I said, was that he wasn't playing my music at certain times like I thought he should be doing, and nor was he giving me an opportunity to put some music up there. And we played dances or whatever. And I tormented him about the fact that we were working these things together to death. Every night we played Satin Doll and Sophisticated Lady Mood Indigo and so forth. And to move over and make room for something so we could make some more progress, because as long as he kept playing the old stuff, he wasn't going to develop anything new. So the result, he passes away, and now I'm in charge of what's being played, and I don't play my numbers either. I'm playing Satin Doll, Sophisticated Lady Mood Indigo. I'm playing the things that the public demands. I satisfied myself now, and the difference has come because of the advent of the digital disc. Now there's room for everything, and depends on what the person wants to pick out of there for themselves, but now we can put in a few things And I didn't dare begin to start exposing some of the things that we've had or that we normally play or play in jazz clubs for kicks until we had room to be sure there was enough other stuff in there to make the people comfortable
the
with
solid stuff.
And, yeah, and to hear. And also, I wouldn't even put things in there, which is what we did on this last record and we'll be doing on the next one, given a chance, tunes of Ellington's which are much more advanced than what he was doing from one point to the other. And you'll find this in some of the work that's in the Church album and also works which come from things that are way back, like Diminuendo and Blue. A drum is a woman, for instance. We, from time to time now, inject a tune of his called Ballad of the Flying Saucers. And the lifespan of this tune is as long as the room of the flying saucers are unidentified objects are. So that's as far back as it goes, and yet it sounds like something that's way out and was written yesterday.
That was written when?
Well, back, I say it's easily 30 years old again. You know, so, but we're getting a tremendous modern reaction from it when we do it on concerts.
Do you think maybe you're willing to ignore your own work a little bit more now and put some of his to the forefront because you've simply come to terms with the thing, or because now nobody's telling you you can't play your stuff?
No,
you're
I've said this before, and it's insidious, and I'm quite sure in many cases it's not that it's been taken wrong, but it's not being interpreted as I feel that it is. But I'm not in competition with Duke Ellington anymore because I am Duke Ellington. And what happens now is making sure he becomes the item that is to be remembered and go down to posterity as one of the greatest composers in the world, for that matter. That's my job. That's what I work at, and that's what I'm trying to make certain. Anything else that comes is a bonus.
To use your own words, Mercer Ellington's been quoted as saying that he is now the keeper of the keys. What does that mean to you? Is that what you mean?
Well, I didn't say it. Duke Ellington said it, and that's what makes it so important to me. It's up to me to see the tradition is carried on, that the works and whatever it is that Ellington represented becomes postulated and works well so that people will have it available if they so choose to want it, listen to it, or to play it.
What do you think is the most important work you've done?
The most important work I've done, I think, is the extension of the additional work I did on a through-composed song of Ellington's called The Three Black Kings, which was not finished at the time he passed away. So I had to put the endings and different little bridges and things that went into it to make it a complete work.
Why was that important to you?
Because I had to rise to being equal to whatever it was that he was representing and hope that this would be achieved. To the extent that the musicians are not aware or were not aware that my work was involved in it. And the other thing is that, for instance, when we did Music Is My Mistress, they thought we'd dug something up from the past and didn't know that this was something I'd done almost completely without it.
And that was all brand new.
Yeah,
that's wild. If you could change anything in your whole life, maybe come up with everybody has their own little mental things, their little fantasies. Would you change anything, and if so, what would it be?
I wouldn't dare, because I'm afraid that if I change it, it might not work out as well.
Mercer Ellington went on to fulfill his dream of finishing much of his father's work, and not only to preserve the Duke's legacy, but to elevate his music to new heights with his own vision and to assure them both a permanent place in musical history. I hope you've enjoyed my conversation with Mercer, his openness and honesty in sharing his personal story with us. If you'd like to hear something special or just want to talk about what it is you like best, be sure to leave me a comment either here at the Jazz Scene or on the website itself, markofjazz.com. By the way, here's a little footnote. In case you've ever wondered how Edward Kennedy Ellington became Duke Ellington, at the age of 7, he began studying piano and earned the nickname Duke for his gentlemanly ways. Inspired by his job as a soda jerk, he wrote his first composition at the tender age of 15. It was called Soda Fountain Rag. Duke left us in 1974, and Mercer some years later in 1996. Although now they're both gone, future generations hearing their music will know without question, music was their mistress.